Alan Kring Productions, in association with the Emergent Light Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, for spring semester 2022. Today, capital budgeting. Before I do that, as usual, we're going to have a look at the markets, see what they look like. Now, this is actually something of a bullish day. Notice that you have that classic pattern, Dow up a tiny bit, S&P up more, NASDAQ up even more. Risk and return, there you go. It just kind of keeps showing up in these numbers over and over again. And the Dow is barely up. It's just sort of like, you know, it's not enthusiastic about anything. The Standard & Poor's was really moving upward, but it's kind of lost its momentum here in the last hour or so. But it's still up close to 0.5%, and the NASDAQ is just tearing up the walls. It's up almost 1.5%. So that's some happy news there for you bulls out there in the audience. And, you know, I've heard so many times about the end is near, doom is just on the horizon, and the markets just keep wanting to thwart that. And, of course, there is a tendency with some in the influencers to do things to catch suckers off guard. By warning of bad times, they can get people to do things that they can then take advantage of in terms of investments. And so always be sure that you are aware that there might be another story behind the prognostications of the experts. Moving over here, oil, it's up. It's like I said, it's not going to stay down, notwithstanding releasing a million barrels from the strategic reserve of the United States. It's finding its way back up again, back up above 100. It's going to have a little bit harder time hitting its next goal of 125. There's no question about that, because there is oil on the high seas, oil in the pipelines at the refinery. So it'll take a while, but it's still going to find its way back up, especially since this is a point of criticism that I've gotten, and I've been attacked on several social media sites where I say sanctions oftentimes don't work against countries, because eventually the countries figure out ways around them. And in fact, in my international finance class, I showed how Russia was going to get around the sanctions on it with transaction structures. But in this case, it looks like the last 48 hours have just made the world just so no one wants to deal with Russia. And it's going to get to the point where it's going to be essentially a locked economy. And that unfortunately means that the oil production and the gas production that comes out of Russia will begin to slack down quite a bit in the West. And so that will cause the price of crude oil to go up. And that's a bad thing. But as I've told you, this has a silver lining, because as crude oil gets expensive, well, finally we'll get around to getting serious about alternate energy resources. They are not cheap. Moving over to all of these alternatives is hard, but when you get the price of oil up far enough, it becomes more cost effective. So there is a bright lining to paying those awful gas prices that we may be facing down the road. So always keep that in mind, that sometimes you have to think about problems much more than the average person or even the average journalist does. Moving over here, gold is up some, silver's down some, but there is definitely money coming into the equities. You see, there's people putting money in there. There are investors throwing, where is that money coming from? Well, you know, it's like the bonds, the yields are up, which means the price is down. So that means that there is money being, the investors are selling out of bonds and they're moving into equities. They're using some of the money at least to buy stocks. And that is a reverse of a flight to quality. In other words, that's a bullish sentiment. Get out of the safe stuff and put it into the riskier stuff. So there you are. The thought that we are on the brink of a recession and it's going to be, or I should say, on the brink of a crash of the market. Well, that's probably a little bit premature. market likes to fool people that way. Now, over on the other side of the lakes, in London, the FTSE just finished up, I think, just a little bit ago. It was up a little bit. It wasn't anything spectacular, but it was in positive territory. The Nikkei had a surge, boom, upward there at the end when it closed. That would have been nighttime here. But there's bullish sentiment coming around the world right now. I don't know. It's one of those things where it's an odd situation where you have an absolutely tragic war going on, which could very well expand now that we've seen what happens when we sit on our asses. But at the same time, the markets seem to be thinking, well, you know, it's not a bad time. Contrast that with our yield curve, which is, here's April, the one day we have for April so far, and you see that yield curve has just got a 3 to 10 year inversion. That is a steep inversion, which of course was almost a guarantee that we're going to have a recession in about 9 to 12 months. I was calling it a moderate, but I was looking over the weekend at the numbers, and I'm not sure it's going to be that severe. It might be a fairly light recession. We've got a lot of hiring going on. That's a good sign. The jobs picture is the best it's been in years. I don't know if we're going to have too much of a recession, especially if the world has to pick up all of this production, the different kinds of things that we will no longer get from Russia, especially agricultural products and hydrocarbons. That is going to spur a lot of business production, business development, which is what we are talking about to some extent today, is that if we, in the short run, it's going to be damaging, losing those markets, yeah. But if that means that all the rest of the world has to pick up and cover that, well, that's jobs, that's growth of industries and all of that good stuff, new possibilities for alternate energy resources, new possibilities for production of other goods and services. So there is a bright lining sometimes, even in the darkest clouds. That doesn't mean I'm not a cynic, but you have to be realistic. Maybe it's not as bad as we would think it is right now. Moving out of that, I have an older story, a long-term story from my consulting days about the subject at hand here. But I have a new addition to the story that happened just on Saturday. There was a time, it was way before your time, and it was actually even in my earlier days, when business was kind of a seat of the pants sort of affair. You had to have a genius, a knack for where the good product was, where the best market would be down the road, and all that. And there still is that genius that is needed in the business world. But there's also a much, much greater need than there used to be a long time ago for the numbers, for the exactness, for the precision, for the scientifically correct ways to do things. Much to the chagrin of students and professors alike, we have to do things much more technically accurately than we used to. Part of that is because our competitors are going to do it. So if I build a car and I just guess at what the right diameter of a piston should be, and my competitor builds a car using scientific analysis and the laws of thermodynamics and all that, that my competitor is going to beat my pants off at it. That seat of the pants way of doing things just doesn't cut it these days. And that's why we have these courses. Admittedly, I mean, in some ways, this is a harder course than it would have been as I taught it 40 years ago. I have to do more. We have to use Excel. We have to use calculators and equations more than we used to. It's just the modern world. It's getting more technical, and we've got to keep up with it because our competitors are going to do it. And truth be told, we can't be sloppy anymore because we have to use resources more efficiently than we used to. That is the backdrop for decision making. Capital budgeting is a fancy way of saying deciding what projects are a go and which ones are a no-go. And in the old days, like I said, you could say, well, this looks like a good idea, let's go with it. Or, no, I don't want to do that. And at best, you used really sloppy methods that really had no scientific basis whatsoever. Surprisingly, to this day, a lot of businesses still operate on those, dumbass principles. And I'll tell you about that very specifically here presently. There was a method in business, and it actually goes back centuries. I've seen documents in the Renaissance where it looked like they were using this really old method for deciding what to do and what not to do as far as the business was concerned. No question, by the 1700s, this was the method of choice. And through the 1800s and the 1900s, it was still the method of choice for deciding go or no go on projects. If you were going to use any kind of numbers at all, it was this method that by which you employed the numbers, and it's just plain wrong. It is stupid. It is as dumb as you can get if you have more knowledge of what really should be done. Let me show you this method. Suppose that you have a project that has a, year free cash flow. Now, we don't use profit, we use free cash flow. That's our thing. And in year zero, you're going to punch out $25,000 to get this project on its feet, get it underway. And then in year one, you'll pull in $5,000. In year two, you'll pull in $10,000. In year three, you'll pull in $18,000. And then in year four, it'll begin to tail off to, let's say, $7,000. And in the last year, when the project is at its end, you'll gather $2,000 more. Okay. Now, these are simplified numbers, but it's what I'm going to show you is what is done, what used to be done. They used a method called the payback period. There would be a decision, maybe something that they've had around since anyone can remember, of a number of years that the project has to be able to come in under to be able to pay off the project's initial cost. Let's say that this company has a payback period of 3 years. No project will be accepted unless it can pay back the initial investment within 3 years. Okay, well, if we look at this right here, in year one, there's the $5,000. In year two, it has brought in a total of $15,000, $5,000 plus $10,000. In year three, it has brought in $32,000. In year four, $39,000. And in year five, $41,000. Okay, this project is a go because it covered the initial investment within 3 years. So you would say, yes, this is a project that is absolutely, we're going to do this one. But if the project had not made it to $25,000 within 3 years, they'd say no. It's an old, old method. Here's the first flaw. These numbers, $5,000 is a year away. It's not worth, you can't compare that $5,000 in year one to $25,000 negative in year zero because you haven't taken into account the discounting phenomenon, the time value of money. It's even worse in year two. $10,000 2 years out is more like $8,000 now, depending on your discount rate. $18,000 in year three, that's quite a bit less if you talk about it in now dollars. So these numbers are not comparable to this original amount. You would have to discount them back, take the present value of each of those at some discount rate in order to have be able to compare these free cash flows out here to that initial free cash flow at the beginning that was negative. That's a critical flaw. You say, okay, well, we can do that. Discounted payback period one. Oh, we've got it. Well, there's an even more fundamental flaw, a much more fundamental flaw. Where did the 3 years come from? Well, I don't know. That's our decision. That's what we do. Okay, why? Well, that's the way we do it. Now, I ran into a number of companies as a consultant where they were still using payback period. You ask them, where did you get your number of years for the payback requirement? The number of hurdle years? I don't know, we've always done it that way. You got a problem with it? Yes. Where did it come from? And that is something they can't answer. Well, that's the way we feel. Okay, you feel, really. In a world where you've got technicians, computers, mathematics, the laws of physics driving business, and you want to do a feel on something, really, as important as an investment in a project. Now, understand, though, that this is how it was done for centuries, and it is still being done that way to this day. In fact, there are two correct methods, one superior to the other, but there are two that are mathematically, financially right. One, I'll show you those in a few minutes, NPV and IRR, net present value method and internal rate of return method. A survey was done a few years back of major companies in the United States. How many of them use each of the methods, payback period, NPV, IRR? The plurality of companies, I think it was about 45% of the companies, said they still use payback period. Large companies still using a method that is just on several levels wrong. It's just not right, but they use it. Why? That was the question, that one of the follow-up questions. Well, that's what we use. That's our policy. In other words, they're hiding behind just a rule instead of giving a rationale for the rule. And so I ran into it in my consulting business. Virtually all of the small companies for which I consulted, they just said it. They had no idea that there was any other way that you should do it. Now, some of these were people who had MBAs, and yet that had just gone right over their heads. We've been teaching this whole thing for years now, and it just, well, there's what we do in theory, but you know how that is compared to what we have to do in the real world. Okay, I'll get off that. But I was at a luncheon on Saturday with several executives of a relatively large company in this region, and they actually, one of the heads of the treasury, was making fun of a couple of MBAs that they just hired who didn't understand that the payback period is how we do things. And they were paying for dinner, lunch, so I didn't say anything, obviously, but you know, it was like, okay, you've got the state-of-the-art people with the state-of-the-art knowledge, and you are actually making fun of them when they are right and you are wrong? God. But okay, that's where it is now. The payback period method. Now, the reality is, what are you going to do if you go out into a company and you find out they're using the payback period method? Are you going to say, excuse me? No, you're not going to do that. You want to eat that night. You want a job. The whole point of what we do here is to, as you get forward in your careers and you get power, you get authority, you get influence, you can bring that what you learn here to bear on these companies down the road in the future. Not right away, but the echo is going to reverberate in the business world as time goes on. And maybe by the time I'm teaching this in 20 years, that number of companies that use the payback period method will not be 45%. It will be more like 44% or something like that, or 40. We're hopeful. And this isn't just this subject. We know that in a lot of situations, the best practices, the state of the art, that's not what's being done. And I mean, it's frustrating when you see it like that, but you know how it is. There are two things that happen. One is too much tradition, and the other is too much fad. And you go either way on it, you're going to shake your head if you're in the middle, kind of a rational person. Okay, let me work on something else here. I'm going to take this on a side stream. The book brings this up, but then the book kind of avoids talking about it too much, and it is a really important issue. And it has to do with best practices, and it also has to do with planning for the future now instead of waiting to the end. You see this value right here at year 5? There is something that happens. One thing I need to point out. When we talk about projects, we talk about a timeline. There is not a project that lasts forever, notwithstanding some products that have been around since I was a kid. You make projects so that there is an end point. You don't say, well, we're just going to keep going on this until we'll see what happens down the road someday, or this will always be popular, this is going to sell like hotcakes until the end of time and all that kind of stuff. No, don't do that. Have a time limit. You are not married to projects. You do them until they begin to lose their power. One thing that can happen is, of course, that whatever it was, this technology that is in this product goes away. Another thing is that if you're actually really successful, I guarantee you, you're going to have knockoffs and competitors come in and swarm you, and they'll take away your mojo real fast. And I even consulted for companies that had that happen in the blink of an eye. In one case, I had a company, before it could even get its first delivery to put on store shelves, a competitor had gotten the product out on the shelves before them. Why? Because they had production made in Taiwan, and the Taiwanese just knocked off the product and made their own and shipped it to the United States. Amazing. It was a mod for the old Atari games that made them much way cooler than they were supposed to be. And these geeks had built it. I helped them get money for it, raise capital, and sure enough, they had production made on Taiwan, and they got a knockoff. They waited. They delayed production of this company's product, made it themselves, and got it onto the shelves in the U.S. So especially if a product is going to be really successful, you're probably going to have the competitors, the barbarians are going to be swarming over the gates faster than you can imagine. So projects do have a finite life. And that's especially true anymore with as fast as technologies are moving. Good grief. I'm going to show you next week when we do free cash flow analysis. I'm going to show you there are companies that plan a 4-year, a very cool electronic project, and they say, nope, 4 years, we shut it off. We don't even wait for the death. We don't even wait for it to start coughing in its old age. So, yeah, have a timeline. We end here. We stop this. We either close down the production or we spin it off or whatever the hell we need to do to get out from under it before it turns into a zombie on our books. Okay, that's the first thing. Timeline. There is a finite life, and don't think that there isn't. There is, and know what it is. Make the plans. Always be flexible, of course. If the product's still doing great, yeah. But make a plan for when it ends. Now, the second thing, much more important, that last year is going to be a year when you're selling off the last of the product, you're getting everything, thinking about what you're going to do to replace it and all that kind of stuff. But there's also something called salvage value. Now, if I say there's a salvage value, you add it to the free cash flow of the last year. It can be knocked dead. It can be larger, positive, or negative than even any of the other cash flows in the project ever were. The big, big one is environmental remediation. It is, you're going to have to clean it up. And back in the day, you might be able to hide it, bury it. Not anymore. I guarantee you the EPA, both the state and federal level, are going to be swarming over your butts to find out if there was anything toxic, hazardous, or otherwise in need of remediation when you shut it down. Well, we'll deal with that at the time. Don't do that. Plan now so that when those people who are in the company at that time and facing the shutdown, they can open up the pages and they can see, okay, here's the plan for this. Here were the cost estimates. We'll have to revise them. But you have given those future people the blueprint for the end. You do that at the beginning. You get the estimates of what you're going to get at the end. Now, sometimes that can be positive, and sometimes it can be negative. I'm going to tell you a story. Don't tell anyone I told you this. I found there's a special room here in the College of Business you've never seen. Now, I thought this was where we kept the bad students, you know, until they died, but it's not. I mean, I found out about it because, some years back, 7 years ago, it was in 2015, I think, there was this, promotion of the College of Business, and they wanted photographs of everyone who was in the College of Business, as far as staff, professors, and all that, deans, all that, and associate deans. And so they knew that I was a professional photographer, and they said, can you do the photo shoot for each person? And I said, well, yeah, I'm going to have to set up a studio, the decent lights, the nice backdrop, and Red Bird backdrop or whatever, and the soft boxes and the triggers. And I said, I don't know where I'm going to do that because, there's not a lot of space in this. Oh, they said, well, we've got this giant room. You mean that place down there in the basement behind the cafe that the door's always locked? Yeah. Whoa, okay. Well, and so they opened the door. Of course, there were cobwebs around and mice scattering. No. But then they turned on the lights. And I saw a big room. I mean, it's big. And maybe as big as this room right here, maybe bigger. But all along the walls were all of these computers and boxes of equipment. I mean, these were old computers, the kind with those ginormous, heavy. Have you ever seen those monitors that are like this? I mean, there were state-of-the-art monitors that were 13 inches. They were the size of your cell phones now. And there were boxes full of modems, dial-up modems. You know what? You've heard, those ones that you used to beep, 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 and all that kind of stuff. Those were down there. And I was looking at the computers. They had computers. Now we use flash drives. Before that, there were floppy disks, the hard things. You might have seen those. And then before that, they had these wide 5 1/4 inch that were kind of, that's where the term floppy came from. Before that, there were these ginormous ones that were 8 inch. You grab it, boom, boom. Like that. Those were down there. And the computers for them. Boxes and boxes. And boxes of things like telephones with those cords that had already stretched out. They used to be spirals, but they all stretched out. All of this stuff was down there. When they upgraded, they would put it down there in that room and just leave it there for some other time, some other place. This is what I'm talking about as far as salvage value. They could have donated that equipment. They could have sold it. I mean, it was back in that time, when they upgraded within 3 years, so they weren't that far out of date when they put them down there. They could have sold those. I mean, donating those. Could you imagine the schools at that time? We've got a bunch of computers. Would your middle school like to have those computers? Oh, my God, we would have gotten geeks back in that time, and probably gamers, too, but there's that. But we didn't. And this is actually very not all that unusual in companies. They'll just put it in storage and walk away and pretend it doesn't exist. But we know it does because there's an opportunity cost, the cost of what you could have done with it. And if you do decision-making without taking into account opportunity cost, I guarantee you, sooner or later, your butt will be burned by what you have failed to do as far as recognizing the value of things. Now, on the other side, environmental remediation. If any of you ever drive around this town, down there on GE Drive, have you ever noticed that ginormous factory down there that's abandoned? It's just like a derelict building there. That was mothballed, and the company just walked away, just left it there. I guess they're planning to leave it there forever. That does not mean that it is not an environmental nightmare. It is asbestos waiting to kill somebody. It probably has toxic waste of other kinds in it. By the way, did you know that computers are actually a hazardous waste? They are a hazardous waste. Your cell phone is actually a hazardous waste. All of that stuff in there is just a giant pit of exposure to liabilities for the company. Well, the company sold it. Well, someone owns that liability. Either the original company didn't sell the liabilities when it sold that building, or the new owners owe that. But sooner or later, it has to be fixed. Ignoring that as part of the salvage value as a big negative is just you're not evaluating the project properly. It's the total cost of the project. And if you ignore that cost at the end, you're going to be accepting projects that should have been left to die. So keep that in mind, that environmental remediation is a huge one. There's also another one called the liability tail, a general liability tail. The best example you could have of that was the private airplane industry. Many, many years ago, I was a private pilot. Back in the day, you had all these cool airplanes like the Cessnas, those are the ones with the overhead wings, and the Pipers, and the Beeches, and the Moonies. They were all cool airplanes. And then these companies would sell them in the 1960s and 70s and in the early 80s. And then in the 1990s, these planes started killing people. The wings cracked on them. The fuselages broke open. The landing gear failed on impact at landing. And people were killed. And people sued these companies back to the Stone Age. And these companies stopped producing. Some of them were driven into bankruptcy by the lawsuits and the settlements. And the awards given. The company said, oh, we're going to stop making that airplane. Lol, let's move on. Not looking at the possibility that there would be a liability tail that they would have to deal with, either with putting money into a bank account and letting it stay there and grow to pay off settlements, or to buy an insurance policy against future liability exposures. They ignored that. And they did so at their peril because those ghosts came back to bite them in the butt years later. So you can pretend these don't exist. That doesn't mean they don't exist. And they can come back to end your company years and years after you walked away from the project. We're finished with it. Lol, let's go on. We're fast and loose. We don't have to worry about what we've done. And there it was. These projects that were no longer even there. They didn't even have technicians who knew those planes, so they didn't have very good expert witnesses to defend themselves in court against the lawsuits. Salvage value. Find out how much you can make by selling the equipment that you're ending the project on, selling the building. Find out what the exposures are as far as liabilities go, environmental remediation, liabilities of other kinds. Get those in and put them in the last year of the project. Put them there. So in other words, if I say the revenues in year five were $2,000 with a salvage value of negative $8,000, you're going to put in there $2,000 minus $8,000 or negative $6,000. If there isn't any, well, cool, you know, that's fine. But be objective. Don't think we can ignore things that might be. Always say, be that voice at the meeting of the planning stage. What about at the end? Now, they might throw you out the window, but it's sure going to be helpful if someone raises the concerns about shutdown of the project. I'm bitching at you about this so that you have this in your portfolio of knowledge when you go out there into that real world somewhere. Okay, enough of that. I'm going to put up another project here on the board, give you the free cash flows. Let's have a look at it. One thing I will tell you is that with calculators, the financial calculators in Excel, this is a lot easier to do now, and it's also good because it's more efficient so that we can look at what-if scenarios much better now than we could a long time ago. Let's do one year free cash flow, and we'll do year zero. We're going to do a $50,000 out-the-door cost, and then we're going to do year one, a $10,000. That's our first year. Year two, we're beginning to get some brand recognition on the product. So we get up there to, let's say, $15,000. And then there's more product adoption. So we're going to be up here at about $25,000. Then we're going to have the tailing year when you begin to get that die-off, competitors are coming in. Let's say that that is about $8,000. $8,000. I'm doing millions. $8 million. And then in year five, we've got $3 million. And the salvage value pluses and negatives, what we can sell the equipment for, minus remediation and other shutdown costs. Let's say the salvage value is $4,000, $4 million. I'm saying thousands, but these are millions. So in other words, we would put that on here and then plus salvage value. So year five, you're going to put in a total of $7 million. You got $7 million. Like I said, it can be positive, it can be negative, but it's, you need to put that in there, one way or the other. Okay, so now, what I'm going to show you is the NPV, the net present value method. Now, what we're going to need to do is find a discount rate. And we're going to discount each of these free cash flows back according to its year, and then compare the sum of those discounted values to the original value. Now, the first pass at a discount rate, and I'll talk about this here in just a minute, would probably be, and you'll see companies do this, they'll use the weighted average cost of capital, the WACC of the company. And let's say the weighted average cost of capital of the company is, let's say, 8%. No, let's do a 6%. This is a big company, millions of dollars. Okay. So in order to do that by hand, I would have to take $10 million discounted 1 year at 6%, plus $15 million discounted back 2 years at 6%, plus year three, $25 million discounted back at 6% for 3 years, $8 million discounted back 4 years at 6%, and then $7 million discounted back 5 years at 6%. Now, I want you to picture me 30 years ago doing this with chalk on a green giant board, 1 year at a time, calculating each of those and making mistakes and cussing and swearing and then giving up and saying, the hell with it. We don't have to do it that way anymore. As a matter of fact, even in the earlier 80s, we had a spreadsheet. The first one was SuperCalc, and then there was a giant called, a little later, called Lotus 1-2-3 that did these, and we were just so grateful for that, for these kinds of calculations. Now you can do them on your stupid little calculator here. I'll show you. It's called the NPV. I showed you using this in a place where you shouldn't use it. And so now I'm going to show you, pull out your calculator. For heaven's sakes, do this with me. I'll give you a minute to pull them out here. Interestingly enough, back in the late 70s, when I got back into college at the end of the 70s, early 80s, there was actually, we had time on supercomputers, the one at Ohio State. We could go in there when there was slack time, and we'd write Fortran programs to do this kind of stuff. And then the personal computers started showing up, and we didn't have to go over there into that freezing cold room anymore. But anyway, here we go. Now, you're going to do apps, finance, and you're going to go down to the NPV. Now we're going to do it the way it's supposed to be done. We're going to use the first thing you put in is your discount rate as a percent number. Remember, it's an app, so you use the percent. Don't put in 0.06, put in 6. And then you're done with that, so you give it a comma. Now we put in what it expects next is the initial cash outflow. In this case, negative $50 million. Now I noticed on the quiz there were more than a few of you who forgot to put this comma. The comma says, I'm done with this. Now you're going to give it the positive free cash flows. You start with a brace, second parenthesis that opens a brace, and you just lay them in one after the other. 10 million, comma, 15 million, comma, 25 million, comma, 8 million, comma, 7 million, and now we close the brace to tell the calculator, all done, and close the parentheses to finish the app. So this is a positive net present value project. It's a go. We accept the project. That's what we say. We accept the project. At a discount rate of 6%, we take this, we say yes. And we go with it. It is that straightforward. Now, this can really get frustrating to others in a company. Marketing, if it's a marketing campaign, an ad campaign, or if it's some new production idea that has come about to save money or whatever it is. This can really annoy those people because they put all that work into it. And for us, it comes down to a number. Positive yes, negative no. Even if it's negative $5, it's a no. Okay, now let me take you one more step today. What if someone said the weighted average cost of capital is not what you should use? That's the overall risk of the company. This project is a lot riskier than the overall risk of the company. So they apply, they find a beta that would be appropriate based on other companies. They use CAPM, something like that. And they say, you should have used 14%. 14%? You mean I have to do all this again? No. All you have to do is say second, enter, and the formula comes up for you to edit. I can skid over here and simply put in 14%. Now, it's going to overwrite the 1, but I'll have to insert to put the 4 in. Now, I can guarantee you that makes it a lot easier to do what ifs. You ready? Here we go. Oh, it's negative. So somewhere between 6% and 14%, this project went from a go to a no-go. There was some percentage. Oh, God, do I have to look everywhere for that? Back in the day, yes, you did. Our dirty trick was we'd get 2 of them, and then we'd very carefully graph to see where it crossed the 0. That was how we used to do it. But somewhere in there, and I'll show you how we do it now, and that'll be the lecture on Wednesday, but that's all I have for you today. I thank you.